From Kansas to Florida, Missouri to Alaska, this is American Radio Journal. On this edition, socialism is all the rage on the American left, but every country that has tried it has fallen into economic devastation. Dr. Lee Edwards of the Heritage Foundation is here with a look at socialism's record of failure. President Trump and congressional leaders are talking about a $2 trillion infrastructure plan to rebuild the nation's roads and bridges. Scott Parkinson of the Club for Growth has the real story. Former Vice President Joe Biden has jumped into the Democratic presidential race, but can a more centrist candidate win the nomination? Eric Boehm and Peter Suderman of Reason Magazine explore. And congressional Democrats just can't accept the Mueller report. They dragged Attorney General William Barr in to testify. Colin Hanna of Let Freedom Ring USA has an American Radio Journal commentary. I'm Loman Henry, and welcome to American Radio Journal. You need only look at the economic destruction and civil war engulfing Venezuela to see the impact of socialism. Still, the left is trying to convert America's free enterprise system into so-called democratic socialism. Dr. Lee Edwards is a historian and distinguished fellow at the Heritage Foundation. He joins us now to talk about the failures of socialism and the success of free enterprise. Lee, welcome to American Radio Journal. Doctor, let's begin. There's this great move among the left in this country to try to move us to so-called democratic socialism. Tell us a little bit about the history of socialism. It's been tried a number of times throughout history. The success rate, not so good, is it?
Well, as a matter of fact, it's been tried in some 40 nations over the years, about a century now, starting with the Soviet Union, and it has failed abysmally in every single instance, whether we're talking about the Soviet Union, which wound up by sending those people who did not want to be socialists to the gulag to die there in the frozen tundras of Siberia, to Venezuela. And we look and see what's happening in Venezuela today and in the last several weeks and several months. To me, it is a perfect example of what happens when planning leads to dictatorship. And that's a direct quote from F.A. Hayek, a Nobel laureate. And here, Venezuela, one of the wealthiest, most happy and prosperous nations, now reduced to rioting, to inflation running in the thousands, to a gentleman named Maduro trying to enlist the military, holding desperately onto power when the people have said they would like to have an alternative in Mr. Guaido. So to me, all we have to do is to look at the record, look at the history books, and we'll find out that socialism has been an abject failure for almost a century.
Lee, the record of history is quite clear on this. How do we come to a point where here we are in 2019 and this ideology has become resurgent among particularly millennials, but a certain segment of the American left? Why is it now reappearing when it's very clear that socialism is an abject failure as not only a philosophy, but as an economic system?
Well, I think we have to look and see what is the fact that the left has been working at trying to prepare the climate, if you will, the culture even of our society for this kind of a socialist takeover for almost a century, beginning with FDR, who back in 1932, when he was running for the presidency, the Franklin Delano Roosevelt, said that government has a responsibility for the well-being of its citizens. Now, no president had ever said that before. And this was the beginning of a socialist tilt. And the socialists have been working at it, preparing it, and hoping that the American people would not do their due diligence in studying what the record has been. So here we are, very close to having an entitlement society run by bureaucrats in Washington, D.C., with socialist principles guiding it. And that's one of the reasons why we have this soft receptivity to it, particularly among young people. They just don't know what the record is and what the history books tell us about the abject failure of socialism time and time again.
Conversely, let's take a look at free enterprise and capitalism. Now, Lee, if you were to listen to the left and you were to listen to the socialists, they would say, capitalism is all greed and it's just a few becoming the wealthy 1% and the rest of the world is living in poverty. That's not true, is it?
Well, I think the best example of how what I call American capitalism works, and American capitalism has special emphases both on innovation and on the individual entrepreneur, and I think it's something special about our form of capitalism. We had one of the most dangerous, I think it's fair to say, one of the most dangerous declines in our economy back in 2008 with the Great Recession. We came out of it. How do we come out of it? Do we come out of it by having more government, more taxes, more controls, more regulations, or did we allow the American capitalist system to work and to bring us out of it, which is exactly what's happened? So today, as we know, the GDP is up, unemployment is down. We've come through that testing, and it seems to me that's proof positive that American capitalism works as opposed to the failures and the decline over and over again, the absolute collapse of those countries which try to regulate themselves via socialism.
The Heritage Foundation each year publishes an index of economic freedom, and it takes a look at economic freedom all around the world. The most recent index is showing that because of capitalism, a number of countries that had really been stuck in massive amounts of poverty are actually working their way out of it. Lee, where in the world are we seeing capitalism working its magic in terms of bringing countries out of poverty and at least into some amount of economic prosperity?
Well, would you believe Botswana, right in the middle of sub-Saharan Africa, is a beautiful example of allowing capitalism to have its way, to get government out of the way, to let the people and the entrepreneurs there in Botswana. That is happening throughout, as a matter of fact, not only in Africa, but also in countries in Asia as well. According to our index, the Heritage Index, something like 100 nations, mostly from Africa and Asia, are going upwards towards more prosperity through freedom.
If memory serves me correctly, and this could be an alarm bell, the United States in that index has been dropping in recent years, has it not?
Well, it did drop the last couple of years, but now is beginning to make a comeback just in these last couple of years. And I think we can look to the White House and its adoption of such things as cutting taxes and deregulating to be accounting for that. But, you know, getting back to socialism, just very briefly, if I could, I'm asked from time to time, well, sum it up. So I like to say it's a pseudo-religion founded on pseudoscience and enforced by political tyranny. And that's precisely where we are in Venezuela today. Hopefully, coming out of that will be a turning towards democracy and freedom and away from socialism.
We have been talking with Dr. Lee Edwards, who is with the Heritage Foundation. He is a historian and a distinguished fellow with Heritage. And Lee, tell us a little bit about Heritage. Also, where can folks go to read more?
It's pretty simple. It's just heritage.org. For a recent couple of articles which I've written about socialism, in which I try to lay out the record and the abject failure of socialism all of these years. So heritage.org, pretty easy to remember.
Lee Edwards of the Heritage Foundation. Lee, thank you for being here.
My pleasure.
Scott Parkinson is at the Club for Growth this week. A lot of activity on Capitol Hill. We're going to talk about several key issues. Scott, as always, good to have you here.
Thanks for having me.
President Trump this past week, Scott, met with Chuck Schumer and Nancy Pelosi. The talk was a bipartisan deal on infrastructure investment, i.e. spending billions of dollars on roads, bridges, and other types of transportation infrastructure. Tell us a little bit about what's being proposed. And I guess the big question, Scott, how's all this going to get paid for?
Well, that's a good question. Will they even try to pay for it? Well, so what happened was President Trump met with House Speaker Nancy Pelosi and Chuck Schumer, the Senate Minority Leader, they brought in about 12 other key Democrats from Congress, including key chairmen and key influencers. And they came together at the end of the meeting and decided that the goal would be to have a $2 trillion infrastructure package. Now, this is a sort of an aspirational goal. President Trump has made a big campaign promise in 2016 that he wanted to rebuild infrastructure in America. And I think that that's a worthy goal if it's done the right way. Congress should be prioritizing spending projects. And if you're going to create additional $2 trillion in spending, you should have an offset in spending cuts. We don't want to see a revenue increase, a tax increase to pay for additional spending. That would be tax and spend model that never works here in the U.S. economy. And one thing that the coalition groups have come together recently and said collectively is that we oppose a gas tax increase. Many people in the administration have been proposing a 25-cent per gallon increase in the federal gas tax, and that could bring in about $400 billion in revenue over 10 years. Still not even enough to pay for a $2 trillion infrastructure package, but it's a considerable amount of money. It would really have an impact on how much you pay for food, how much you pay for clothes, anything that's transported through semi-trucks. It would have an impact on your direct discretionary spending abilities in terms of how often you fill up the tank, if you're going to be taking vacation. All these things play into the American psyche and how we choose to spend our money. When government confiscates more of our money, we do less of the things that we really want to do. So it's something to keep our eye on, but I think that it's fair to say Club for Growth is leading the charge, along with many other conservative groups, in opposing a gas tax increase to finance an infrastructure package.
Meanwhile, over in the House of Representatives, there's been some movement on components of the Green New Deal. What's happening there in terms of the fixation that the left has on so-called climate change?
Well, that's right. If you remember, in the summer of 2017, one of the first big things that President Trump did was withdraw the United States from the so-called Paris Agreement. The Paris Agreement was something that President Obama did in his executive authority, and joining the United States with other nations, pledging to combat climate change and reduce U.S. carbon emissions. Now, that promise did not go to the Senate for a treaty, and it was merely an executive agreement. So that meant that President Trump had the ability to completely turn it off. So what's happened now is that this week the House Democrats propounded a vote on the Climate Action Now Act, which was H.R. 9, and this bill would have forced President Trump to comply with the agreement that President Obama did with those other nations in the Paris Agreement. Now, what does this mean? It means that, number one, if the United States had to comply with other countries in terms of reducing carbon emissions, it puts us at a competitive disadvantage. Number two, the United States is already a leader in reducing pollution through innovative solutions. And number three, you've got the U.S. economy currently growing at a faster pace than any time underneath President Obama, and the carbon emissions are actually declining, notwithstanding Trump's refusal to participate in a global deal that puts these U.S. companies at a competitive disadvantage. So we obviously opposed the Climate Action Now Act. If something like that goes through, you would see very slow economic growth, a decrease in U.S. productivity, and wages would become stagnant. You'd kind of have a reversal back to the economy that we had underneath President Obama. So we certainly oppose that.
And while Democrats in the House might be for it, its chances in the Senate, I would expect to be less likely to pass there. And in the end, it's something President Trump can veto. So this might be more posturing on the part of the Democrats in the House. Speaking of posturing, Scott, they continue to talk about so-called Medicare for All, which is basically a synonym for socialized medicine. What is the latest move by the Democrats on Medicare for All?
Well, the extreme liberals in the House are not hiding their cards very well in terms of taking our country towards socialized medicine. This week, we had the first official hearing on Medicare for All in the House of Representatives. I think that that's super indicative of the direction that they want to take America on in terms of health care. They're not even fighting to preserve Obamacare anymore. They want to take a farther step left to have single-payer health care at the government level and totally abolish and eliminate all private health insurance. This recipe, you wouldn't be able to keep your doctor, you couldn't keep your pediatrician. The quality of health care would dramatically decrease. I think that the cost of health care would also dramatically increase because government would be paying for it. We need to preserve private health insurance. We need to have a health care marketplace that encourages innovation and competition among state lines. So Club for Growth is leading the effort to show what health care should look like in a free market economy, while Democrats on the left are certainly not hiding it very well that they want to take away your health care and have a government-run health care, Medicare for all, for everyone.
And the battle continues. We are talking with Scott Parkinson. Scott, of course, is with the Club for Growth. And Scott, typically we like to end our discussion by having you tell us a little bit about the club, also where folks can go if they would like to get additional information.
The Club for Growth is a membership organization based out of our nation's capital. And if your listeners are interested, they can check us out on our website at www.clubforgrowth.org. And if they like what they see, they can join for free. I would also encourage everybody to check us out on Twitter at Club for Growth with the number 4.
Scott Parkinson of the Club for Growth. Scott, thank you again for being here.
Thank you.
Can an older, white, more centrist male win the Democratic presidential nomination? Eric Boehm and Peter Suderman of Reason Magazine are here to discuss. Eric?
Joe Biden is officially in the race for president, and he looks like he may be a serious electoral juggernaut for the other Democrats seeking the nomination. Hi, folks. I'm Eric Boehm with Reason Magazine. Thanks for joining us on this edition of American Radio Journal. My guest today is Reason Magazine features editor Peter Suderman, and he is the author of a new piece up on the site. It's up at Reason.com right now. The headline is Joe Biden and the Limits of Moderate Politics. We're going to get into that in just a second. But first of all, Peter, thanks for joining us here on the show today.
Glad to be here, as always.
Joe Biden, of course, he has just entered the race in this past week, officially, after thinking about it for a while. He has shot up not just to the top of the field, but really well beyond all of the other candidates. He's the clear front runner at the moment, if the polls are to be believed. And I think, Peter, and I'm curious to get your thoughts on this, seems to me like he's really more of a juggernaut than people might be assuming. Obviously, Biden has some baggage that he's going to have to deal with, but in a field that is now, what, 21, 22 candidates wide, if you can poll at 30% consistently, it's really very difficult for anyone to catch you. I mean, that's what we saw Trump do in 2016, and Biden is, he's at that level. If anything, he may actually be beyond that level.
Yeah, I think that's right. And I'll make two cases here. The first is basically the one that you just laid out, which is that if you look at Biden's poll numbers, his entry into the race actually gave him a bump. He was polling at the top before he entered into the race. And now Morning Consult, CNN, Quinnipiac all have him in the high 30s. So he is just beating everybody else in this very large field by a pretty large margin. And if you look at what voters, Democratic primary voters, say they want in a candidate, it's electability, the ability to beat Trump. Biden is certainly the candidate with the longest history in Democratic Party politics, the most electorally successful. He's been vice president. And in addition, they also say that they want the party to move in a somewhat more moderate direction, which is something that you might not expect if your primary exposure to Democratic politics these days is Bernie Sanders and people on Twitter. And so Biden feels like a moderate to a lot of these folks. He feels like somebody who can win an election. And in particular, he feels like somebody who can win an election against Donald Trump. And I think that pretty clearly explains his appeal to Democratic primary voters. If there is a case against him, it's Rudy Giuliani in 2008. Rudy Giuliani was very popular with Republican voters coming less than a decade after 9/11, right? America's mayor, that whole business. And Republicans, he basically led the field for a full year before the primaries actually happened. And then once we got to Iowa, support for Rudy Giuliani completely collapsed.
Yeah, certainly it's still early. These polls, they're not predictive of anything. Take them all with a grain of salt. We have no idea what's going to happen here. But Biden has a clear advantage when it comes to name recognition over just pretty much everybody in the field as a former vice president. And I think that's probably a big reason for his lead at this stage. Let's switch gears for a second, Peter, and talk about policy here instead of the horse race stuff. As you said, if your primary exposure to Democratic politics is from Twitter, you might be surprised to learn that there are still centrist and moderate Democrats out there. Can Biden play this moderate role and win? Is that the silent majority here?
Democratic voters, when you poll them, like I said, what they say they want is a candidate who is more moderate. They say they want a party that is more moderate. And in the context of the 2020 field, in which you have half a dozen candidates endorsing Medicare for All and the Green New Deal, which are, if I want to be generous and kind, I would say they're extremely ambitious progressive policy plans. If I want to be a little less kind, I'd say they're pie-in-the-sky liberal fantasies that come out of a completely fantastic democratic socialist worldview. But either way, like in a field in which you've got a lot of kind of progressive types, conventional Democrats who are on the progressive side, endorsing policies like that, and in which Biden's biggest competitor is probably Bernie Sanders, Biden really does look like a moderate. And I think that that is a fair way to describe him. But what I've tried to argue in the piece is that his moderation is all relative. And if you looked at Biden 10 or 20 years ago, you wouldn't have called him he's a moderate Democrat. You would have looked at Blue Dogs, which are basically a caucus that doesn't exist anymore, of relatively conservative Democrats from districts that might at times vote in a Republican. And you would have called, we had a term for people like Biden back then, and it was big government liberal. And that's what he is.
Yeah, I suppose it's easy to look like a moderate when you're running against literal socialists, or at least democratic socialists, I guess. We are talking with Peter Suderman. He is the features editor at Reason Magazine. We're talking about Joe Biden's candidacy and his lead in the polls here in the Democratic primary race for president. Peter, not a whole lot of time left, but if you had to pick something, what would you say is Biden's biggest liability in the Democratic field? I mean, if something is going to knock him off the perch that he's on right now, if anything, what would it be?
If you're a libertarian or if you're a small government type, the biggest drawback is that he's Joe Biden, big government liberal. But if you're a Democrat, if you are on the Democratic side of the aisle and looking to pick or thinking about the 2020 primary field, I think the obvious thing is that he is old, white, male, and handsy. In an era when that kind of behavior can just bring someone down in an instant. And the fact is it hasn't yet. And in fact, Biden has done quite well coming out of the gate here. But I still think that there is a real chance that sort of looms in the background and comes out to bite him or make his political life quite difficult here over the next year or so in a pretty real way.
There is, of course, a long way to go, certainly a long way to go, several months out from any votes being cast. And much further than that from anything actually being decided on the Democratic side. But I think clear at this point that Biden is the front runner. He's who everybody will be gunning for. Peter Suderman from Reason Magazine, thanks for joining us here on the show.
Thanks for having me.
And again, Peter is the features editor at Reason.com. You can check out his latest there on the website. It is Joe Biden and the Limits of Moderate Politics. That's the headline. You can find it at Reason.com. I am Eric Boehm. Thanks for listening. And you can catch me right back here again next week on another edition of American Radio Journal.
Congressional investigations into the Trump administration continued this past week as Attorney General William Barr was summoned to Capitol Hill. Colin Hanna of Let Freedom Ring USA has this American Radio Journal commentary.
Do you remember when the mainstream media at least claimed to be objective? Cable TV news has always been more one-sided than the major networks, but the major national newspapers and news magazines, while hardly free of bias, nevertheless tried for years to portray themselves as the keepers of the high standards of legitimate journalism. The recent coverage and editorializing by the New York Times and the Washington Post following their coverage of the Senate hearing with Attorney General William Barr, shows how far these once great media have fallen as they intensify and attempt to normalize their contempt for the Trump administration in general and Attorney General Barr in particular. The Post's editorial board wrote, quote, "Barr has lit his reputation on fire, and he has just added more fuel during his testimony before a Senate panel." Much of the hearing centered on the Attorney General's decision to release a highly misleading representation of the findings of Special Counsel Robert Mueller's Russia investigation. Close quote. I'd like to present an alternative view, one that is more fact-based and well-documented than the pure vitriol that now emanates from the Post. And I'm pleased to say that the source is my good friend and former colleague here at Let Freedom Ring, Matt Makowiak. Matt is a former press secretary to two U.S. senators and a veteran Washington and Texas-based political consultant. He's also a regular contributor to several TV news channels. Here's what Matt wrote in the Washington Times. Quote, "Like clockwork, a selective leak from the Office of Special Counsel to the Washington Post on Tuesday night detailed a letter that Robert Mueller sent to Attorney General William Barr after he sent his four-page Mueller report summary to the letter to Congress on March 24. The headline purported to describe Mueller's dissatisfaction with Mr. Barr's letter. Had Attorney General Barr misled the public? Democratic partisans and media figures pounced. Had Attorney General Barr perjured himself before Congress? At least one sitting senator immediately called for Mr. Barr to resign, and the Speaker of the House accused him of perjury. As usual, the hype far outpaced the facts. Mr. Mueller told Mr. Barr that nothing in his four-page summary letter was inaccurate, but that he preferred that his summaries be released to the public because Mr. Mueller felt the news coverage of his findings was confusing to the public. Mr. Barr decided not to release the summaries, which needed to be reviewed for redactions, and to instead prioritize the full release of the Mueller report with redactions, which would include the summaries. How is releasing a full report worse than releasing summaries? As it relates to lying to Congress, this is a situation where the specific language matters. Mr. Barr was never asked if Mr. Mueller provided negative feedback to him directly after his letter to Congress. Mr. Barr said, "I was not interested in putting out summaries or trying to summarize." It's unfortunate the Washington Post has a higher profile than the Washington Times. It may have been deserved at one time, but no more. The bottom line is simply this. There is no middle in America these days. No middle in Congress. No middle in the media. And that leads to no middle in the electorate. As our media become increasingly digital, they also become increasingly binary. We are divided into what management guru and author Ken Blanchard calls two warring win-lose camps. This has created a leadership vacuum and the need for a new kind of leader to emerge who can lead us back to a sense of national unity. We need a leader who will take us back to the ground on which most Americans agree, the statement of American values expressed in the Declaration of Independence and the Constitution. Have we heard from any of the contenders in any of the 2020 national races, President, Senate, or House, say something like this? Do we hear any of our opinion media, any of our editorial boards, calling out for that kind of leader? Until this idea catches on, we will be headed for disunity rather than unity. I am recording this commentary on Thursday, May 2, the official National Day of Prayer. I can imagine no more meaningful prayer to offer on behalf of our nation in 2019 than this, and that it can be prayed every day, not just on a day officially designated for it. This has been Colin Hanna of Let Freedom Ring for American Radio Journal. Visit us on the web at letfreedomringusa.com.
American Radio Journal is heard on public affairs-minded radio stations all across the country, including our newest affiliates, WKBN-AM, WNIO-AM, and WBBG-FM in Youngstown, Ohio. Welcome to our new listeners in the Buckeye State. American Radio Journal is produced weekly by the Lincoln Institute of Public Opinion Research, Incorporated. The Lincoln Institute is completely funded through the generosity of individuals, corporations, and philanthropic foundations, which underwrite the costs of this program. Comments and opinions expressed on this program are those of the guests and do not necessarily reflect the views of the Lincoln Institute or of this radio station. Learn more about American Radio Journal and hear expanded versions of some interviews aired on this program. Please visit our website, AmericanRadioJournal.com. I'm Loman Henry. Thank you for listening to American Radio Journal. American Radio Journal, lighting the brush fires of freedom.